Hello, one and all. This is Ashley Vance. Welcome you to episode 12 of Semi-Coherent Computing. This week, we're checking in with Nick Carr, who has just published a new book called The Big Switch. Nick was the former editor of the Harvard Business Review and made a pretty big name for himself in the tech game when he published a paper saying that IT doesn't matter and kind of questioning how much companies were spending on technology and how much of an edge they could get over their rivals through tech. We'll talk a little bit about that, and then we'll also talk about the book where Nick paints a picture of where he sees data center technology going and how the trends he's seeing may or may not replicate what happened with the rise of the electricity industry and the move to kind of utility-style electricity. But that's really just the first half of his book and the first half of our chat. We're also going to talk about some more philosophical angles about the future of computing and how companies like Google are becoming sort of add-ons to our brain already. And the book is a pretty fascinating read. And as always, Nick has a nice wit and take on what's going on in the computing industry. So with that, let's go ahead and check in with Nick. Well, Nick, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
So congratulations on the book. I was lucky enough to get, an early access copy, and it's very dog-eared and well-received. I really enjoyed the book, and it's pretty easy for me to say. I think most of the listeners on this program would enjoy it as well.
Well, that's great to hear, and I hope you found it worthwhile and spurred some thinking and ideas and stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I guess just to start people off a little bit, could you give them I've explained a bit of your background, but I haven't seen a ton of information on the web about how you got interested in technology and this mix of technology and business. Can you walk us back to even the pre-IT doesn't matter?
Yeah, it's kind of a strange story because it goes all the way back to when really I was in graduate school, and I started off planning to be thinking I might be a English literature professor and went to grad school for that, but decided it wasn't for me. And after getting my master's, I bailed out, and so I was at that point I had to figure out what to do for a living. And I ended up getting a job as an editor at a management consulting firm. And I had never, studied business or economics or anything, but ended up staying there for 12 years in doing a lot of writing and ghostwriting, marketing, all sorts of stuff like that. And one of their practice areas was information technology management. And this is back in the late 80s, early 90s. And I did a lot of work with them and kind of began teaching myself not only business, but also IT issues. And then later on in the 90s, I left there and became an editor at the Harvard Business Review. And at that time, this was 97, late 97, I think, the Harvard Business Review, their editors were pretty much clueless about technology. They just had no one there working in the technology area. And so kind of by default, I took that over as well as some other things and began, editing pretty heavily lots of IT and internet-related articles. And then I also, during that time, I was also editing strategy articles. And so that's where my kind of joint interest in the strategic implications of IT arose. And then I started doing some columns for the Industry Standard about the intersection of IT and business. And then ultimately that led me to the idea for IT Doesn't Matter. And the rest is history.
I didn't realize you wrote for the Standard. Those were the good old days.
Oh, yeah. Through 2000. Right up close to the point where it died.
Yeah. I used to work for IDG as well, and I worked for the news service, which was kind of this internal newswire, and I could, they had this huge billboard in San Francisco near the bay where the Industry Standard headlines would go across in these massive letters, and I used to be able to write a story and then go out in the balcony and see my headline in lights. You never got the byline, but you got your headline in lights. So then it was 2003, if I'm not mistaken, when you published IT Doesn't Matter in the Harvard Business Review.
Right, that spring.
And so that, as someone who was kind of covering companies like HP and IBM and Sun and Dell, I can say how well received that story, that article was by them.
Yes, it was a much loved article among the IT vendor world.
I don't want to spend too much time dwelling on the past because, you know, I'd actually rather talk more about your new book, but yeah. We should give people some perspective. I mean, in that piece, you write a lot about how, you know, IT had matured to the point where if people thought that they could just pour millions and millions of dollars into their infrastructure to gain a competitive advantage, you kind of questioned that notion and said, well, maybe, you know, you're not going to get the kind of lead over your competition that you might think.
Right. The meaning of matter in the title was whether it matters strategically and whether IT can provide a company with a meaningful competitive advantage. And as you say, my conclusion was that for most of the types of IT investments that companies make, not just infrastructure, but also most of the broadly used applications, it had become hard, if not impossible, to get a strong competitive advantage, in that this pattern kind of followed historical patterns with other important technologies, that they can provide a very strong advantage early in their existence, but then as they mature and become more commonplace, any valuable new innovation tends to be copied and diffused through an industry very quickly.
Right, and then, you know, like we were saying, I mean, Carly Fiorina and I think Scott McNeely and those guys would get up there and try to refute this proposition as much as they could. And we just had Jim Barksdale on, who's another kind of good example. You know, I think you talk about FedEx a bit, and he was the CIO at FedEx. And so that was like one example of a company that did use technology to gain a huge edge over the competition. But, you know, over time.
And even in that case, it wasn't all that, and this is not taken away from them because they're a great user of technology, but it actually wasn't that long until UPS caught up and in some ways leapt ahead of FedEx. So that kind of, the ability for companies to catch up increases, I think, as a technology, any technology, but IT in particular, matures.
Right. And then, you know, a lot of the ideas that you had in the paper and then the book, you kind of build on the big switch. And again, you take this angle of looking at an industry that's kind of been through this before. So maybe we should start kind of with the basics, I suppose. You know, you spent a lot of time looking at the electricity industry and kind of the throes that it went through. You know, and I want people to read the book, so I don't want to go through bit by bit through the book. But can you give us, you know, the overarching, I guess let's start with the soundbite on the big switch and kind of what the big idea is here.
It's a book about how the nature of computing is changing and how more and more of the computing power and data storage and applications that we rely on are running out on the internet essentially in utility data centers, and how that trend will continue and how it's going to reach broadly, I believe, over time into the corporate world. I think it's already reached pretty far into the world of personal and home computing. And then I look at the various economic and cultural and social and business changes that may emerge from what is in essence a new utility industry. So that's kind of the big theme. And then, as you note, I spend quite a bit of time drawing an analogy with what happened to mechanical power in the with the rise of the electric utility 100 years ago.
Yeah, I think the book's pretty, it's amazing because there's kind of two books. One's very historical based, and then the second half kind of gets into more philosophical ideas. Or even, I thought you could even take, it's almost each chapter, I mean, chapters are supposed to be, you know, thought to themselves, but you could even do almost a book, I thought, on several of the chapters in there. At the beginning, you start talking about thin clients, and you're kind of in a data center, and you know, I was a little skeptical and surprised at first because you're so cynical on your blog, and you, it's kind of something that a Register reporter would appreciate. But you know, I felt like at the beginning I was almost talking to like Larry Ellison or Scott McNeely in 1996. We were talking about thin clients, and I was curious to see where you were going to go because it seemed like you totally bought into you know, this kind of thin client computing idea. And I was surprised that you started there.
You know, my view about the book and my view about what's happening to information technology in general is that, and this ties back to the electric utility analogy as well, but is that first you have to look at it from what's going on from a technological perspective. And as I point out, even that, you can't look at technology in isolation. You have to look at its economic influences, how it influences economics and how economics influences it, because that the economics of the technology is as important as the technology itself in determining how it will play out. But, you know, what I sought to do in the beginning of the book is really try to get a read on how IT is evolving and developing and advancing, and kind of in lay out, you know, that scenario and that perspective. Because I think, you know, even though Sun, you know, the people at Sun and Larry Ellison and many others have talked about thin client computing or utility computing in past years, it's only really recently that we've seen this big shift really taking hold, I think, in that, and largely because of we finally have the fiber optic broadband network necessary to distribute really rich applications and rich computing over the net. So I don't think it's, you know, I think it's less about the thin client model itself taking over as what I describe as the World Wide Web becoming the worldwide computer. And so the microprocessor and the disk drive or the flash drive in your own local device, whether it's a PC or a smartphone or whatever, is part of the computer. And is very important. It's not like there's no computing going on locally, but the real heavy-duty computing and application running is, I think, shifting to the internet, to this worldwide computer. And, you know, we see it so strongly, as I said, in the personal side of computing. If you look at, you know, how people, particularly younger people, students, how they use their PC or other computing devices today, it's very, very different from what it was, say, 10 years ago. You know, nobody's going out to a store and buying software and a software program and unwrapping it and installing it on their hard drive and troubleshooting it and everything else. They're just, you know, firing up their browser and using web-based software. So this kind of this change has really taken hold, I think, in the personal side. And it, I believe, it's only a matter of time until it moves into the corporate and enterprise world as well.
So, just like I was saying, I mean, you know, some grizzled computing veterans and everything, you know, they might be just cynical about. They hear the words utility computing, or they hear, you know, we're kind of shifting to this online model. It's like, oh, come on. We've heard this 100 times before, but even in my reporting, I've noticed there is such an emphasis on stuff like thin client computing again, and obviously these web-based apps. I mean, it's kind of hard to deny. But you mentioned bandwidth before. Do you think that's kind of the, because I've just been trying to pinpoint what's changed in the last couple of years to make people jump back onto this again, and it seems like at least, you know, readily available broadband seems to have the biggest impact on all this.
Yeah, I think that's really what's what precipitated the change we're seeing. And you're absolutely right, by the way, that, you know, utility computing, people have been talking about it since the early '60s. But it's only with the broad the rollout, the, you know, zillions of dollars that were invested in fiber optics in the late '90s and early part of this decade that we've had the rich infrastructure to begin transmitting, you know, really complex applications over the net. And one way to think about it, and I talk about this in the book, is that everybody knows about Moore's Law, which says, you know, computing power for a given price is going to double every year or two. But Moore's colleague at Intel, Andy Grove, in the '90s sometime, came up with Grove's Law, which said the capacity of communication networks only doubles every 100 years. And, you know, he meant it as a dig at the telecommunications companies, who he thought were going very slowly.
Right.
But nevertheless, it gets across the big kind of gap that's always existed between computing power and the ability to transmit that power over a network. And I think that explains why companies and individuals for many, many years had to run their computers locally, either if we're talking about a PC, you know, inside using their own hard drive and their own microprocessor, or companies using their own local networks, because if you wanted to gain the latest and greatest computing capabilities, you simply had to do it that way because the network was not sufficient enough to centralize those things. But I think over the course of this decade, suddenly Grove's Law has kind of been repealed, and the capacity of the network has kind of caught up to the power of the microprocessor. And so now you are able to centralize the distribution of a lot of computing functions that used to have to take place locally.
Right. So I want to get eventually to the kind of mega data centers that are, you know, delivering out these services. But kind of before we get there, I'm going to drag us back a little bit to talk about the analogy you make with the electricity companies. And it's not that big of a leap for people to imagine what it would have been like for companies to manage. They essentially had to manage their own generators just to ensure that their business was up and running. And you make some really interesting points about companies. It was almost like FedEx 100 years ago or something, where a generator became, if you did things right and you had a really efficient electrical and mechanical system, I mean, that was a competitive advantage for some companies.
Right. The story about the rise of the electric utility and how it led companies to abandon their private generating systems is a fascinating story in and of itself, and that's why, one of the reasons why I go through it in the book. But you know, when you think about it, there is a very close business analogy between what's happening with computing today and what happened with mechanical power that back then. Now, like any historical analogy, it breaks down at some point, but at an economic and a business level, I think it's very interesting, because through the end of the 19th century, if you were in business, if you were a factory owner, a manufacturer, you had no choice but to produce the energy required to run your machines. And maybe that was by building a water wheel or installing a steam engine, or a little later building your own electric generator. But there was, you know, business people and factory owners would never have imagined that they wouldn't supply their own power through their own local private generating function. But then as soon as you have the invention of the alternating current electric grid at the end of the 19th century, and you suddenly are able to supply what used to be supplied privately through a central utility, it's only a matter of decades before companies dismantle their water wheels and their steam engines and their private generators and plug into the grid, for the simple reason that the economics of getting their power that way are so superior than the private generating model. And yet, and this is, you know, this again is a very close analogy to what we're seeing with computing, is, you know, at first, all companies were very suspicious about, you know, dismantling their own private generating station, because if there was a glitch in power supply, they were out of business. I mean, this was, as we say today, a mission critical function.
Right.
And yet, as you know, ultimately what they found is that the central utility model both provided power much, much cheaper and ultimately became more reliable and more flexible than their private plant. And, you know, at that point, all companies moved in that direction very, very quickly.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's the reliability thing that's kind of key, right? Because at some point, it's like, well, I have to take the risk that if my provider goes down, you know, it's putting me out of business, but the odds of them going down are less than me doing it on my own anyway.
Right, right. And that became particularly true as the electric grid built out. And so, you know, you weren't just relying on a single generating station somewhere. You suddenly had this whole grid of power supply that became over time quite flexible, and so it became much more reliable than, you know, your own private operation that could break down or, you know, get flooded or whatever.
And so in the tech world, obviously companies have this very strong relationship with their data. And the thought of having, you know, a third party having access to your data and managing it and doing it properly is, I mean, that's more or less what's prevented a lot of the rise of utility computing to date, along with, I guess, just the pure economics.
Yeah. Without dismissing or diminishing that concern, the concern about giving up control over data. And, you know, there are real regulatory issues in some cases with that. So it's nothing to dismiss. But I would still argue that it's not as big of a deal as companies often make it out to be, in that there's no particular reason why a central supplier can't have equal or greater protection of one company or one person's data as that company can achieve through keeping its data locally. And indeed, if you look, you know, if you look at what companies do with their information, it's certainly not true that they don't let other companies touch it or handle it or whatever. The first great utility software application was payroll, which actually, you know, moved over from being something that companies ran themselves to being something that companies mainly outsourced quite a long time ago. And of course, payroll information is extremely sensitive to most companies, and you wouldn't give it to an outside company unless you absolutely trusted their ability to keep it protected and secret. And more recently, customer relationship management systems have been the most popular of the so-called software as a service applications. And again, we're talking about companies' information about their contacts with their customers, which also is extremely sensitive. So I think what we see is that, you know, even though this is a big concern, and rightly so, that if a supply model emerges, if a supply industry emerges that can gain the trust of companies and that can deliver some greater functionality or at least cheaper functionality than those companies can get on their own, then companies are quite willing to let their information flow out and be held by an outside data center.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, who those companies might be. On one side, you've got the guys, you know, you mentioned this early on, it's worth pointing out, you know, IBM with mainframes, and I mean, the old time-sharing model was kind of utility computing a long time ago, so this isn't a new concept in some ways, but at the same time, so you've got IBM and HP and Sun, who've been pushing grid computing and utility computing for quite a while, and then now we have this new class of vendors like Amazon and eBay and Google and Microsoft coming now, and then obviously a company like Salesforce.com, but, you know, the really big ones delivering these interesting kind of web services. And I guess you have a quote in the book where you say some old line companies will succeed in making the switch to the new model of computing. Others will fail, but all of them would be wise to study the examples of General Electric and Westinghouse, who kind of were able to transition their business by selling not only generators, but then kind of appliances for consumers to use. And I don't know, as someone who covers servers, you've got me pretty fascinated looking at over the next 10 to 20 years who shakes out of this. Let's take Sun as an example, because that's a company during the telco boom. They were at the heart of the whole dot-com rise, and they were the company that everyone was turning to provide these mega scale kind of services. And then you look at, they rolled out their dollar per CPU per hour and their storage effort, which has had a tough time, mostly from a regulatory angle. But while Sun was messing around with that, Amazon came up and actually started delivering services to smaller software makers and smaller companies. It's a big question, but between this, the hardware world and this service provider world, do you think both sides will have, you know, people that make the transition and that deliver these kind of the utility service, or does it look, I don't know. I get the feeling that you tend to see kind of Amazon and Google is leading the pack now.
Well, I think I see companies like Amazon and Google, being out in front, but it's as much, and you hinted at this, it's as much in who they've chosen to focus on what clientele, which is certainly smaller companies, smaller to mid-sized companies, developers, schools, organizations that are capital constrained, that don't have huge amounts of cash to invest in, their own hardware, their own servers, their own data centers, and also their own licensing big enterprise applications. And so what the utility model does is it basically lets smaller companies level the IT playing field. So, if you're starting a new web business, you can now tap into Amazon's system, which is, obviously a state-of-the-art computer system for delivering internet applications, without having to lay out any capital, without having to invest any capital. You pay the monthly fee. And so I think Google and Amazon, Amazon on the infrastructure side, Google on some of the more basic application side, provide the best way of understanding what's going on. The big question is, will they be able to move up into serving larger organizations? And I think they'll certainly come up against a lot more competition, to say the least, when they do that, because I think most of the major IT players are not going to sit idly by. But this is playing out in the classic terms of a disruptive technology, as the business strategist or a business academician Clayton Christian described, which is that the big disruptive technologies tend to take hold at the lower end of the market, among smaller and mid-sized companies, and then inevitably they get better and better and better, and they move up and begin to displace some of the traditional technologies among bigger companies too. And I think that's going to be the path that this takes as well.
So out of IBM, and I'm going to ask you to see into the future a little bit, obviously these companies are looking to make large data centers, where instead of even a smaller and mid-sized company, you're talking about something like an Exxon, looking to tap into your data center. So what happens? Like, somebody among IBM and HP and Sun and Dell kind of get it right, and they...
Well, I'm going to cop out a bit and say, I don't know which particular companies are going to come out on top, for the simple reason that I don't know what they're going to do. So it's hard to predict. But I do think that, we're in a transitional time when the reigning IT model for companies is going to be a hybrid model, where big companies in particular aren't going to close down their data centers and throw out all the software they've created or licensed overnight. And what I think is going to happen is that for the large companies, they're going to take some of the basic technologies that underlie utility supply, things like virtualization, for instance, in essence build their own internal IT utilities that are very flexible, very cheap to run, and very automated. And so we'll have, and this is already, we're already seeing this. We see all the big server makers, IBM, with its recent, Blue Cloud Initiative, and right. HP, and certainly Sun, and even Dell are all trying to get into the business of in essence, building utility computing centers for companies that will either run them themselves or use them to supply, software as a service applications. So I think we're gonna see a lot of big companies invest in internal utilities while also beginning to pull in more and more services from the grid. And so there's going to be trying to be the supplier of choice for building these utilities. It's going to be a place of an area of big competition among traditional server makers. And then if you look a little more further into the future, things get very cloudy for traditional hardware makers. Because if we have, and even, Sun is suggesting this, if we have a massive consolidation and centralization of computing where you have, in essence, three, four, or five big suppliers who are fundamentally running the big computing grids, what role does the traditional component supplier, the server maker, the data, data drive maker play in that industry? And certainly the bad news for the traditional guys is that these utilities could get in the way of their usual relationship with the end customer, and instead they find themselves serving these big, consolidated, powerful utilities. That's a lot less attractive of a business model than supplying thousands or millions of separate end users. And of course, then you have the most kind of threatening probably aspect of all this is Google's data centers, Google's network of data centers, and because Google does not buy servers from traditional server companies or pretty much any other hardware, it cobbles its own stuff together and uses its own versions of open source software to run everything. So, a utility like Google does not need the IT industry to supply it. And so the worst case scenario is that the Google model takes over.
Amazon and Microsoft and Yahoo, they're still kind of buying systems, at least from Rackable Systems, which pops up a lot. Declare it in their SEC filings. But like you say, I mean, Google's making its own switches, its own servers. So they're kind of avoiding the traditional players altogether. Yeah, I'm curious because Sun CTO Greg Papadopoulos, he's the one who always talks about these five mega data centers. I see why Sun emphasizes that, because it's kind of in their DNA to talk 10, 20 years out and to think that way, but they've never said what they're going to sell to fill the gap in their revenue once that happens. Yeah. We see them selling thin clients today. But in your example about GE and Westinghouse, a company like Sun has to figure out what else it can attach to the network. I mean, it becomes, if it wants to survive and adapt, it has to become what, like a consumer or a business electronics kind of company? Again, it's just too hard to say.
Well, I mean, for one thing, I think it's pretty clear that Sun doesn't believe that the Google build it ourselves model is going to last. It believes that in these transitional periods, the pioneer will have no choice, in essence, but to build its own system. But then system building will become its own industry, and so Sun wants to be the head of that industry and basically building these utility plants. Of course, that still begs the question, if there's only four or five of them, it's not a big market. But more broadly, if you look at what GE and Westinghouse did, they were obviously they started off by supplying the components to individual companies who built their own electricity generation systems. And then when generation became centralized in utilities, they pursued, I think, three different businesses. One is they became the supplier of utility scale equipment, really huge generators and generating systems to the utilities themselves. And they also became utilities, or at least they invested in the utility industry. And then third, they realized, and I think this is also important for IT, they realized that once you have this utility set up, it's going to drive down the cost of the technology, in this case electricity, and radically increase its availability. And that's going to mean that's going to lead to inevitably a whole lot of new applications of the technology, which in the electricity area meant a whole lot of new consumer appliances. And so both Westinghouse and GE moved into that business, which became a huge business in its own right. And so those might be the kind of options that the traditional IT suppliers have as well.
We talked a little bit. We mentioned Amazon's utility service, and you talk about it a fair bit in the book. And we've already kind of positioned it as right now it's kind of smaller to medium-sized businesses. Do you think this is actually kind of a long-term viable business for Amazon, or is it more of just a sideshow for the moment? What's the end game for them?
I think it is a viable business for Amazon. I mean, it's certainly been all indications are it's been growing very quickly. There are also indications that it's probably not profitable for Amazon right now. And so you know, I think making a go of it as a business will require two things. One is continued growth in consumption, in use, which gives you greater and greater scale, and then also more sophisticated pricing. And it was, you know, pricing. Those were the two things, scale and pricing, that were critical to the rise of the electric utility industry, and I think are pretty much critical to most utilities, and I think will be critical to the computer utility as well. But and so I think it will be, and I think Amazon is investing in it with this in mind, that it will be an important, or could be an important business for Amazon. And also, but also it's interesting to note that it gives Amazon a way to more efficiently use this great computing system it's built. Because as Jeff Bezos, the CEO, has said, there are times when the Amazon system, just running its store alone, runs at about 10% of its capacity. And you can certainly understand why, because retailing is such a spiky business. And, you know, right now they're probably go through the holidays, and they're probably having very high capacity utilization, and then it'll get very, very low at other times of the year. And so what offering, you know, by allowing other companies to tap into its system, what it does is it's able to use its capital investment, utilize it at a much higher level, and also inevitably, and again, this is a basic truth about utilities, as you get more and more different types of companies or individuals using the service, the demand becomes much less spiky, much flatter, and thus more predictable. And when that happens, that allows you to be much smarter about investment, and it allows you to get your capacity much closer aligned to demand. And it's at that point that you can start making some real money from this business. And so the cool thing about Amazon moving into this is it kind of shows the two sides of what I think will push companies to the utility model. One is that these private fragmented data centers running, you know, with servers dedicated to individual applications, and with the whole data center focused on supplying just one company, are extremely inefficient. And you know, 10% utilization is by no means abnormal for them. Once you move to the utility system, you suddenly get much, much higher efficiency in the delivery of IT, much, much higher rates of capacity utilization. In Amazon, we both see the need of the individual company for more efficient IT, and also the opportunity for the supplier to be a much more economic source of information technology.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. I don't know what Amazon tells you. You know, I wrote about the service, and I was kind of suggesting that I wonder what happens to them during the holiday season. Do the customers get kind of constrained? But I was promptly told by a PR person that, you know, Amazon dedicates very little of its own infrastructure to this service, which I thought was a funny line to take, because I mean, that kind of kills some of the economics
right
behind this. I mean, do you get a sense as to how much of this is PR spin and how much is, you know, it's like, don't worry, customers, we have enough for you?
Yeah.
It seems like you're trying to have the best of both worlds.
I mean, I also try, when I was doing research in the book, I also asked them, you know, a similar question, because it's an obvious question. Well, you know, you have low capacity utilization today, but if this utility business is extraordinarily successful, sooner or later, you're going to reach a point where, you know, you're going to start being capacity constrained. And then when Christmas time comes around and the store has a spike, you know, who suffers? And as with you, they didn't want to answer that question. And I think, and you know, some of that is because they don't want to create, you know, doubt among the buyers and everything. But I think more fundamentally, that ultimately it isn't an issue, because for just the reasons I talked about, if you can, you know, expand your user base widely enough, you start to, as they say in the electricity industry, you know, balance your load, and you don't have those spikes because just by the nature of demand, if you get a lot of different customers with a lot of different demand patterns, they start balancing each other out. So I think what Amazon is counting on is that over time, the load does become flatter and more predictable. And, you know, they will invest in more capacity, more machines, more data center space and what have you, and will be able to, like other utilities, will be able to manage the demand. And so, you know, this is all my speculation and you know, drawing my own inferences, but I think that's what they're counting on.
Right. In the book, you had the example of the fellow from Chicago that went out of his way to get demand from users who consumed a lot of electricity at night, and then also users who consumed electricity during the day to get that load balance. And in right. the book, I mean, you kind of present him as one of the first people that was able to make the electricity grid kind of economical by really putting in the effort to match those two sides.
Right, that was Samuel Insull, and he shows that, you know, for a utility business to really get going, it's not only a matter of having the technology to centralize supply and distribute it over a network. You have to have very smart business people thinking about things like pricing and marketing and all of that stuff. And he did that with the electric utilities, and you know, similar. Similar people are going to have to come forward and pioneer the business model of being IT utilities.
Right. So just because of the time and the way things are going, I'm going to change gears on us a little bit. But, you know, and this is kind of the way the book changes gears, as I mentioned. And I think Andrew Orlovsky, who also writes for The Register, either through talking to you or writing about your book, will touch on some of these other issues a little bit more than me because they're near and dear to his heart and he's not a data center geek. But, you know, through your book, you bring us to this world where we're talking more about web-based apps and we're talking about really just, you know, kind of the networked world and what it means to have all this information. And you take a company like Google, you spend time talking about their data center like we've done on the program, but then also, you know, what Google means to society,
right,
more or less. And so the second part of this book dives into this whole philosophical and kind of cultural exploration. You know, I think people who are familiar with your blog will know some of the issues you explore, but maybe let's start off at, people think of a networked world a lot of the time as kind of this populist, there's citizen journalists running around everywhere, keeping people honest, and there's Wikipedia, you know, where the truth comes from society, and you know, the network gives individuals a lot of power to reach millions of people. You know, you definitely put a cynical take on a lot of those ideas, arguing that I think you say somewhere that we're heading towards potentially a culture of mediocrity and kind of this illusion that the masses have this power, but really it's like a talented few who can kind of corral all this power who may benefit.
Right. Just to go back briefly, is that we can have these enormous technological changes that are very exciting and make complete sense economically. And they tend to, and because of that, the people who lead the way, who tend to be technicians, scientists, engineers, they get very enthusiastic about the technological change, and they begin to assume that all the effects will necessarily be good. And you get this kind of utopian rhetoric that you always see when you get a big new technological advance. And we see that with IT and with the internet as well. But, you know, I think as we saw with electricity, the ultimate effects of the electric utility, and in particular the effects of making electricity very, very cheap and very, very available, were extremely complicated. And, you know, there were very good things, but there were also things that were less good and even bad. And I think when you start looking at the ultimate implications of of having this worldwide computer, as I put it, which provides everyone with very, very cheap and enormous computing power and data storage, it's going to change a whole lot of the economic trade-offs that determine, you know, how culture is shaped, how employment is shaped, and whatever. And certainly in the media industry today, we see a lot of those, the early stages of a lot of those changes. And as you say, you know, one aspect of this is to give individuals, you know, a lot more power to become broadcasters or publishers or what have you, to, you know, have their blogs and make videos and upload them to YouTube and everything. And yeah, that in one sense, that's liberating, and it, you know, breaks down some of the barriers that used to be there with the mass media. But it also is radically changing the economics of media. And so you get, you know, you get less promising developments, you know, like the struggles of newspapers and big layoffs of reporters and such. And I think it's naive to believe that a citizen journalism model or a highly populist model is going to necessarily be able to replace what it destroys. And so what we may well see is that some of the aspects of culture and media that most of us would consider some of the best aspects of media, those aspects that require professionals, those aspects that require some big investments and sometimes risky investments. So everything from investigative journalism to aspects of filmmaking or what have you, they simply may not be able to survive once you dramatically shift the economics of both consumption and production. And I think that's why we see such an upheaval in media industries today. And, you know, my own reading of how this will play out is far from utopianist. I really see, you know, I see in this, you know, I don't want to be one of these people that says, you know, all blogs stink and everything, since I happen to have a blog too. But
I was going to say,
but
yeah,
it's not, you know, that's not the point. It's
most
it's
of
how
them
is
do.
It, go ahead.
They don't all stink, but most of them.
You know, one of the things I get into, as I've said, is just how this affects the economics of producing information goods and cultural goods. And then there's also, you know, another interesting implication is in employment, because what's becoming possible, and we see it with, you know, YouTube or Google or Craigslist or Yahoo or any of these companies, is that you can build today very, very large global companies that basically just run on software. And, you know, can produce their products or distribute their services in essence for free, a very different model that we've seen in the industrial age, and can operate with very, very few employees. And as this, the utility infrastructure of the worldwide computer advances, I think this model of business is going to expand into new areas. And there's a real question of what happens to jobs, and in particular, what happens to income under this model. I think, you know, over the last 20 years, we've seen increasing in the U.S. anyway, and I think in Britain as well, we've seen an increasing polarization of income growth, where a very thin slice of the population gets huge, you know, a huge slice of the wealth. And I think economists debate what the cause is, but most of them agree that information technology and software automation and the automation of processes through software is one of the big reasons. And I think we're only at the beginning of the playing out of that process. So I think we can probably expect that this skewing of incomes, it will accelerate in the years ahead, and ultimately that's going to entail a lot of social pressures and a lot of social upset even. So again, that's another, and that's very different, as I discussed, from what happened with electricity, which destroyed some jobs, electrification, but also created huge new categories of work and helped power the growth of the middle class. With the computerization we've been seeing recently, there's a whole lot of jobs, both blue collar and white collar, that can be displaced, but we're not seeing those big, broad new categories of jobs being created.
It's important to note, I think, first off, that you know, you're not really doom and gloom in your book, but you're very upfront saying, you know, I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but a lot of the rosy kind of techno-utopian stuff that's out there is probably missing the mark on some things. And then you know, I think you stress a number of times just that, well, it looks a little grim here and there. We don't know exactly how it'll play out. So let's wait and see. But, you know, as a journalist, it's clear to me that I don't think too many people will shed tears that there'll be less journalists in the world. It's probably, you know, like having less lawyers or something like that. But people should know this is kind of a flippant example. I have a friend who used to work for Network World, and, you know, just to get higher rankings and more in Google and more page hits, if they write a story about someone like VMware, they have to write, you know, server virtualization software maker of VMware today, you know, and that's in the headline, you know, and then the same reporter, they actually have quotas on the number of hits the reporters have to get. You know, thank God the Register doesn't do anything at all like that. Yeah. But they have to get quotes. So this person used to write about back-end storage, like fiber channel disks, and, you know, had to get the same number of hits as somebody else writing about something a little more flashy on the PC or even Google or something like that. And so every now and then I had to, you know, go digging for a story about an iPod that had some storage angle to it. You know, this is a kind of reporting and the investigative stuff. It's like you said, the odds of companies being willing to fund a lot of the reporting that people do like start to diminish. And I mean, a lot of this, I find it funny. I don't know if you agree, but you look at a company like Google that just has engendered a lot of goodwill towards it, as much as there's kind of cynics out there. But, you know, generally, Google seems like a pretty loved company. And it's an ad broker. And generally, people have this aversion to ads and skip through them on their TV and everything. But this company that's based entirely around ads is apparently great. And like you say in your book, I mean, we're heading to a model where advertising seems right at the center of a lot of what's going on the internet.
Yeah. And, you know, on just on a social level, there used to be, you know, people used to not like advertising. I mean, it almost seems quaint, and it wasn't that long ago that people distrusted and everything. And yet, you know, online, it's not only is pretty much everything supported or, you know, tries to be supported by advertising, there's just tons of ads, but we have the perfect medium to tailor those advertisements to give companies and marketers extraordinarily precise information about who's looking at ads and what motivates their behavior and what their, you know, surfing histories are and what their demographics are. So we're getting this extraordinarily invasive, might be too strong a word, but you know, we're moving to a world where, you know, advertisers have much more information about us, and that, you know, that's one of the aspects of the book. But it we're also, this picks up on what you're talking about on the supply side in the print media. What's going on is I think that, you know, we used to have bundles of information in the form of a physical newspaper, a physical magazine, or whatever. As soon as you move onto the web, the bundle disintegrates, and instead of the product being the bundle, the newspaper, the magazine, it becomes the individual story. And every individual story ends up basically naked in the marketplace. And not only that, but it, you know, it has to earn its keep in isolation. And you can, the publisher can tell if it's earning its keep in very precise terms, because obviously all the click-throughs and page views and everything else are precisely monitored. And, you know, an economist would say, oh, well, that unbundling, or a lot of economists would say, well, that unbundling is great because it gives everybody the opportunity to only look at what they want to look at and not have to worry about all the other stuff that they wouldn't look at. But what that misses is that there was this subsidization that we had, particularly with newspapers, where, you know, classified ads and features about movies or whatever might help underwrite some of the more serious journalism that goes on, investigative journalism, foreign bureaus, all of this stuff. As soon as you unbundle the paper, unbundle the magazine, those subsidizations also go away, and suddenly publishers will start having to make decisions about what to publish based on the individual story and how well it does. And you can pretty clearly see that, you know, a big expensive story about, you know, the rise of some epidemic disease in Africa or something, which in the context of a newspaper could be very valuable because it could raise the profile and of the entire publication, becomes much harder to justify when you move online, because, you know, advertisers with text ads or whatever aren't going to particularly bid up the terms associated with disease epidemics in Africa. So it becomes much harder to justify that type of thing. And, you know, this is going to play out over many, many years. But if you change the economics of a business and you change the mode of consumption, inevitably that's going to influence what's produced. And we can't assume, certainly can't assume, that a lot of very good and important and worthy products are going to simply fail in this new model.
Yeah, it all gets... It's pretty tricky if, you know, the Drudge Report links to one of our stories and we get, you know, say 100,000 people blowing in who might not normally read the Register. It's like, well, what's the value of those clicks really? Because they came for that one story and, you know, we're not going to sell servers to those people anyway. So,
right.
But at the same time, it boosts, you know, the hit count and the audit month and things like that. So, I mean, it's a tricky balance. Learning how to navigate all this.
And, you know, the things you pointed out with just at the very simple level that, you know, more and more you start writing headlines and with the machine in mind, with the, you know, Google algorithms or other search algorithms in mind, you know, that in some ways that might seem trivial, but it also shows that inevitably – you know, these things do filter back into the editorial side and start to determine what gets written and what gets published and how.
Right. You said writing headlines for the machine. This is kind of the really scary stuff that I want to close on. I think people hear about people putting chips into their bodies or, you know, being half man and half machine. And I mean, either that scares the hell out of you or you think it's kind of cool or you just think it's not really...
Yeah.
Going to happen. But there's a simple example. I mean, any of us who are kind of married to our email, you know, you go away for a holiday. I always have like withdrawal that first day when I'm kind of forcing myself not to check email. And it's like, well, it's like you've missed out on that cigarette you have in the morning or something like that. I mean, you feel it's like disconnected from the world and like you just haven't done. It's a weird feeling and one that lets you know you're already a little bit, as you point out in the book, you know, a little bit married to this bigger computer that's out there. But when you're talking about writing headlines for the machine and you talk in the book about we're constantly forcing all this data back into this, I guess what Sun or McNeely would call like the network isn't the networked computer, really. You know, we're just giving this thing more intelligence all the time. And I think it's in the epilogue you say the artificial intelligence we are creating may turn out to be our own. You know, it's a big concept, but can you walk people through where you see this going?
Yeah, that's actually the last chapter before the epilogue, but without giving away the last two chapters, because I'm quite fond of them. But
yeah.
I end with a discussion of, you know, what this machine means, what this worldwide computing machine that we are all hooked into, and we're getting more and more hooked into it all the time. And as, you know, GPS chips, GPS systems proliferated, you know, we can see this with mobile phones already and stuff. You know, this internet machine is going to know where we are, what we're doing, what we're buying, what we're seeing, who we're talking to, all the time, basically. And one thing we know, I think we know, is that companies and governments even are investing huge amounts of money in data mining systems and algorithms so they can draw all this information out to get clearer pictures of us. But also, we're in essence, whenever we make clicks or do anything, or we're putting more and more intelligence into the network. And in a very real sense, we're kind of becoming, you know, nodes of this computer network ourselves, and the network draws on our intelligence to create its own products. And we certainly see this with Google's search engine, which basically mines intelligence out of all of our links and clicks. But ultimately, I argue that, you know, it certainly seems like the machine is becoming smarter, and we can have debates about, you know, what degree of artificial intelligence will ultimately arise. But I think it's clear that, you know, as the power of in computers continues to skyrocket, and as they become all linked together online, the computer system itself is going to be able to do much more of the kind of intellectual work that we used to think required people. But beyond that, you know, the scary thing, I think, is that the internet itself, as we rely on it for more and more of the information we gather and more of the things we do in our lives, it's beginning to shape our own consciousness and our own minds, I would even argue. Just as the development of print, you know, 500 years ago, the printed book and stuff, also influenced the way we think and the way we connect with the world. And you know, there's one quote I draw on in the book where, you know, somebody says that, hey, I don't have to remember stuff anymore. I just go to Google and Google it a second time or a third time, and you know, that shows how our thinking and certainly our memory starts to be influenced by this machine. And so it may sound, you know, like science fiction or whatever, but I do think that when you have a broad new technology that becomes, in essence, the universal medium for information, it inevitably influences the way we think and even our sense of personal identity. So looking ahead, I think mode of thinking that we associate with the print era, which was very logical and linear and required a lot of concentration, a lot of contemplation, is being overturned by the hyperlinked internet era, which emphasizes speed and discontinuity and nonlinearity, and really doesn't motivate us to think deeply about anything or to contemplate anything, but motivates us to move as quickly as we can through information, gather as much as possible. And that kind of ethic, I think we see reflected in, you know, some of the things we hear out of Google or out of Wikipedia or whatever, that it's the mass of information and the speed with which we can get through it that matters, and not the depth with which we think about things. And to me, that's kind of the most ominous aspect of what's going on, is what's it going to do to the way we think about things?
Right. Well, we'll leave everyone with a taste of that, because the book really does get into it more. And I think, I don't say this lightly at all, especially, I mean, you know, the Register, we're usually very cynical and kind of approach things, at least we try to, with kind of a questioning eye. But I mean, I think you handle these topics really well in the book, and it's really a great read. I'm already waiting for kind of the expanded version. A bunch of the chapters left me wanting more, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was tough to, you know, my hope was to get people thinking about how what we're building here and the shift we're going through, how it can have a lot of effects that are surprising and aren't necessarily the ones you would expect, because as with electricity, it just changes so many things. And so, you know, in the book, I try to call out some of the ways some of the changes that are most interesting to me and also might have the broadest implications. But you're right that, you know, there's a lot more to be said about all these topics.
Well, yeah, I was getting to the end and I was starting to run out of pages, and I was hoping that it wasn't going to happen that way. But so it's the big switch, and I'll have links all over the show page for people who want to get the book, and I heartily recommend it. It's a pretty rare book where you kind of go from data centers to the Google brain in one go. Nick, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.